This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The XX Gab Fest is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron sends gourmet recipes and all the fresh ingredients you need to make them right to your door. To see what's on the menu this week, visit blueapron.com. And our listeners get their first two meals free. Just go to blueapron.com/XX. That's D-O-U-B-L-E-X. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, October 16th, the Collection of Body Parts edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, Slate writer and editor, and I'm in the New York studio today with Amanda Hess, also a writer for Slate. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. And Noreen Malone, an editor at New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So our three topics today, and then I will talk about the purse. But first, I want to talk about our three topics. First, teenagers and sexting. Why do they do it? Should we be alarmed? And do we really want to legally classify it as child pornography? No. Second, the misogyny of Gone Girl. The movie version has created this era's perfect psycho bitch. Should women everywhere be insulted? And third, the male feminist. Is there something inherently suspicious about him? Before we get started, I want to talk about the purse dilemma. On our last podcast, I asked readers to help me with something, which was that I'd bought a bag and discovered later that the store never charged me for it. What should I do? Now, from most of our listeners, from many, many listeners, I got totally reamed, I would say. Teddy Roger writes, of course you take it back and pay for it, unless, of course, you're training a band of street urchins to thieve and such. Jacob King wrote a really sad one, which really kind of broke my heart. As someone who works in retail, I can say that when you notice a missing bag, it makes you start suspecting everyone and feel rotten about people. And then Annette Isaacs was, hello, Winona Ryder, of course you need to take it back. which actually, I'll tell you what my son said. He heard me and my daughter talking about this in the front of the car, and he said, Mom, did you do a murder? That's what my son so I was like, damn, like this, I'm in just tricky moral territory here. And then there were a couple of people on the other side, like Alan Thomas, who said the umbrage. Come on, have you never really benefited from some corporate mistake and allowed yourself to keep the proceeds? I know that Amazon once sent me two of the same item when I'd only ordered one, and I just kept it. So there were a couple of defenders. Now, what I realize is that I asked the question completely the wrong way. Like, if I had asked, what should you do? There's only one answer. If you say, what should you do? The answer is no. But if you frame it as, what would you do? Like, what would you honestly sit down and do, most people? Then I think you might get a different answer. So what do you guys think I did?
I think you took it back. I think you were ashamed.
Yeah, I was ashamed. I was definitely ashamed. I felt great shame. And I actually took it back on the morning before the eve of Yom Kippur when I was driving to New York.
That always gets you.
I know. And my daughter wasn't even like into me taking it back. So everyone was like, you must set a good example for your child. But that's not the reason I did it. I actually did it because Yom Kippur is my favorite holiday, though it'd be a really sad holiday. And the reason I love Yom Kippur is because you apologize every year and vow to be good, knowing that next year you're just going to do it all over again. And I find that really interesting. It's like you know that you're going to do bad things and good things the year round, but you're kind of tapping into your own potential, your own conscience. And so at that point, I was like, I'm not a murderer. I returned it. And then the last thing I will say is that the shop girls looked at me like I was nuts. So
Oh,
yeah. This whole business about like the shop girls will get in trouble. Like, no, they were like, they were like, what?
And they made you pay.
They made me pay. And they just thought I was nuts. Like nuts. All of them together were like twittering about what an idiot I was. So much for the save the shop girl theory. But I'm glad I returned it, actually. OK, teens and sexting. Last year, teenagers at a Virginia high school were caught in what news reports described as a giant sexting ring. Photos of 100 high school and middle school girls, naked or scantily clad, showed up on an Instagram page, and police started interviewing the kids at the school. In a cover story out in The Atlantic this week, I, Hannah Rosen, I hate when I talk about my own stories, it sounds weird, explore the case and the culture's confused ideas about teens and sexting. On the one hand, it's totally common. About a third of kids in their upper teens say they sexted. On the other hand, it's still considered child pornography in most states, which is a felony. So, what should we think about sexting? So I'll ask you guys first, when you think about the idea of 100 girls' pictures ending up on an Instagram page, is your first response like outrage, disgust? Like, you know, what's your first reaction to that? I'll ask Amanda.
Sadness. It makes me sad because it is not rare. Mm-hmm. And frustrated, I think. I thought your story was great, and it really explained how it's sexism and not sex that is the real problem. But I think when you, you're talking to these Virginia officials, and I spoke to one of them as well, they are all interested in, like, making teens more aware of, like, how their pictures can be spread and how to, like, not take pictures and send them to their boyfriends, and very little about trying to explain, like, to understand exactly how girls are pressured to do it, how many of them are differentiating between ones who are and ones who aren't, and, like, even bringing up the topic of, like, double standards or sexism among teenagers.
Right.
So I was sad and frustrated.
Sad and frustrated. Noreen, were you surprised by the number of teenagers who sexed? And by the way, I should say it's kids in the upper teens, because studies say all sorts of things, and people will always say, oh, studies say anywhere from 4%, but that's not true, actually. Studies basically say the same thing, that once you're 17 and 18 years old, you it's about a third of kids. So, you know, juniors and seniors, let's say.
Well, Yes, because it wasn't around when I was in high school, and I find I was just so self-conscious as a teenager that I can't imagine, like, doing that. But one of the things you point out in your article is that it's pretty correlated with being sexually active mm-hmm. in some way. And so, yeah, a third of teenagers probably are, by that age, in some way sexually active.
Yeah, I think the more you decide in your head what's normal and what's not normal, or what's okay and what's not okay, the better we do on this issue. So, you know, if you sort of accept it into your head that this is just part of, like, the mating ritual, like, people who are having sex send pictures to each other. Boys do it and girls do it. And we come to understand it as a culture that that's not, like, a shocking event. But what should be the shocking event is when those pictures are used in ways that you completely did not intend them to be used, namely, like, nobody gave anybody permission to put their picture up on an Instagram page where anybody could see it.
One of the most interesting things I thought in your article was you sort of lay out a social hierarchy of the girls who end up sexting and the girls who don't. Mm-hmm. And there was a little bit of, like, class differences, like social class within the high school, right? Like, the girls who are pressured into sexting seem like they weren't quite the really popular girls, or at least those are the girls who are getting talked about as sexters.
Well, Amanda's written about this too. I love this issue that girls police each other in a way which allows them to maintain the class hierarchy. Like, the poorer working class girls will say, oh, she's just a rich bitch. And then the rich girls will say about the working class girls, oh, you know, some things, like, they will say taste things, like the way she dresses or the way she looks. And so that way everyone gets to preserve their own right to continue to have sex,
right,
while
it
putting
is,
sluttiness somewhere
it's
else.
It's almost, like, diabolically brilliant, I think. But also, you know, very upsetting. I found it really interesting that the thing that surprised me was not the amount of kids who are sexting. I guess I'm almost at this point surprised that more kids aren't doing it, but that it was a really small percentage of photos that were forwarded. And so it's interesting to me in a case like this where it seems like there was some sort of social pressure that caused boys who don't usually forward things to contribute to this, like, communal naked Instagram account.
I so agree with you. Actually, one researcher told me, so it's something like, you know, let's say 30% of kids sext. We all have this idea from the public education campaigns, like, you sext. You know, this is the way the public education campaign goes. Guy says, hey, you're so beautiful, I want to see your body. Girl sends the picture over. Guy receives the picture. He's sitting on the bleachers with two of his friends. He sends it to his friends. The next day, it gets out to everybody in the school. Okay, but that actually happens very rarely. And the standard number is something like 10% of people forward naked pictures. I was shocked by how low mm-hmm. that was. Like, that actually makes you happy about the state of
definitely.
Society. And I checked that with several different people because I was like, really? Like, I too had absorbed this idea that, like, you send your picture, it's going out there to everybody. But it turns out that's not that true. You recently wrote a blog post about the law starting to actually focus on this forwarding question, right? Like, you named a couple of examples of cases where the law is starting to give people higher penalties or focus on the idea that you can't send things out without consent.
Right. And revenge porn, although I sort of contest the idea that this usually has to do with, like, revenge, because I think a lot of times it's not ex-boyfriends. Sometimes it's, like, dumb people who want to see naked girls. But yeah, the idea that it is the forwarding that is the problem, I still am not sure that we should be putting teenagers, like, in prison for forwarding photographs.
Right.
And so I guess I'm still unclear as to then, if we decide that that's probably a bad way to proceed, then, like, what do we do?
Yeah, I actually could not entirely settle about that in this case. In this case, I followed an arrest was never made. They never had definitive proof to tie the people who set up the page to the page. And so my question was, what if they had made an arrest? So you have these guys who collected pictures. So they said to the guys at the school and some of the girls at the school, because honestly, some of the girls were happy to be up there on that page, saying, send me any pictures you got on your phone. Once we get 100, we'll open the page. And that's not uncommon. What if they had found those guys and the guys were saying, oh, it's just a prank, we were just fooling around, we were just having fun? What should we do with those guys? I think it is a matter for the police. I'm just not sure what the penalty would be, but I think we should make examples of people who do stuff like that, even if they're just like, I'm just being a dude, I'm just fooling around.
Well, that's like creating I mean, the one person forwarding on, it's like if you're caught with like a dime bag of weed versus like, you know,
right.
you are clearly a dealer.
Right.
But wait, guys, you're not shocked that 10% of people are forwarding on the private photographs that they are getting? I am like, shocked and appalled. And I mean, this is so unbelievably violating of the trust.
Intimacy.
Yeah, yeah, and the trust that you put in another person. Like, think about the impulse that's involved here, like, to immediately just put this thing on the internet for everyone to see. Like, that's actually pretty horrible. And we can't just say, oh, that's a low percentage of guys. Like, that's a 1 in 10 people. That's a lot. So what the fuck is going on?
Actually,
that's okay.
Can we talk about this statistic? Yes. Because I don't recall, and maybe you can help me out. Mm-hmm. Is it 10% of photos that are forwarded, 10% of people? Because there was also this dynamic where it was like, once you've seen a girl naked, like, discard her. And so is it just that, like, you know, a photo of like more than 10% of girls may be forwarded, but just sort of
it was
10%
people.
Of things.
It was people. So these polls will ask, have you ever forwarded a picture? And it turns out that somewhere around 10%. Okay, you got us, Noreen. But here's the thing. So the way the guys talk about these pictures and the girls describe how the guys talk about these pictures, they're not actually that like sexy. Like, they don't, it's not like porn to them. So I mentioned in the story my favorite nonfiction book, which is Thy Neighbor's Wife by Gay Talese. And that book opens with a whole amazing chapter about a teenage boy and his relationship with this naked picture in this Archivist magazine, which was, you know, the Playboy of the era, and how carefully he takes care of this picture. It's an amazing chapter. But he, like, perches it on the edge of the sink so that it will never get wet. And, like, he has so many fantasies. Their relationship with these sexes is nothing like that. They collect them like Pokemon cards, is what one girl said. Or they're like baseball cards. They're less about sex in some way than they are about social status. Like, how many do you have and how many do you have now? I'm not sure I'm making this any better because you look like you're going to throw up.
It's like notches on the bedpost.
Yes.
It's like I collected the pelts from the animals.
Yes.
And it's very primal, but I don't think that means we should encourage it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so what would you do? I mean, this is such a problem because a picture of a minor is child pornography. Literally, if you're 16 years old, you have a picture of yourself that you never sent to anybody in your phone, you could be prosecuted for child pornography, which is a felony. That is true in most states. So what would you do and what would you tell someone to do knowing that teenage relationships are not like relationships when you're 25 years old? Like, teenagers could be fully in love and they could be fully in love for 2 months. So, like, it's always going to be some risk.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't. I think you, like, as parents need to be like, this is special. I mean, the language of it sounds horrible coming out of my mouth, but somehow people have to try to say that, like, we are not all interchangeable body parts, even though sort of we are. But like, like, don't think of that girl that way. And don't think of yourself that way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I recently had a conversation with Catelyn Moran, the British writer. She's really, really funny and wise about all things feminist. And, you know, she used to be a music critic. And one thing she said, she has such a funny riff about the way that pop stars dress. And she was like, okay, so when I was a music critic, some of them, like, sexy would be their thing, right? They were, like, kind of a little bit naked. But not all of them. It's like, how did that become what every single person does? And then she does this incredibly funny riff about, like, what if guys decided that farm tools were the thing? And then, like, at first it was just like, it's really funny, like a couple of guys with a hoe and like a bucket, and then suddenly every single guy was dressed in overalls. And so it did make me think in a new way, like, that they do just absorb this idea that, like, that's just normal. Like, we're all kind of half naked all the time. Because one thing I couldn't understand is the self-conscious question. Like, thinking back to my 17-year-old self, would I have had the confidence to take a naked picture of myself, even if, like, I was in a sexy moment and I really wanted to? I'm not sure. I would have been, like, really self-conscious.
Well, isn't that part of why people take selfies in general, right? Because you're figuring out what you look like to the world and you're showing the world what you think you look like, right? So it's somewhere in between those two things. And teenagers are so obsessed with their own bodies and they're changing. And so, like, they want some sort of, I suspect for a lot of girls, it's more about the affirmation that, like, I actually am sexy than, like, this is hot and it's turning me on, you know?
Right.
Maybe not even just teenage girls, just, like, women in general, perhaps.
It also seemed like for some of the girls you talked to, it was a very kind of sweet almost innocent experience where there was one girl who said, you know, this is the way that my boyfriend communicates how he feels about me and how I communicate my trust to him. And it seems like, at least in her case, that trust was upheld. So it's not, it can be, I guess, sort of like any sexual experience. It can be pretty positive and not damaging.
And in the vast majority of cases, that's what happened. I mean, like, you know, 80-90%. It is likely to be okay. It is likely to lead to nothing. And Noreen's making a face. Now I can see your faces because I'm here. It's so awesome.
I just don't think dick pics communicate much feeling, but that's a personal.
The dick pic is an interesting question that I think we should go into, because it was, you know, you quoted some statistics that showed that, like, nobody's really asking for dick pics, but they are sent at sort of like the same rate. And it is actually, you know, even as someone who kind of like professionally writes about sexism a lot, I was surprised when all of these celebrity photos were hacked recently that there weren't people who just wanted to like embarrass Drake. You know what I mean? With like, he definitely has like sent like a million dick pics, and like, why has no one found them? And so, I mean, it is, that part is really crushingly depressing to me, that there is no even sort of like embarrassment economy for like a photo of a naked man.
Yeah, like you have to be a politician.
Yeah.
I wonder what a teenage girl actually thinks when she receives a dick pic. Is it just like, you know, he wants me to do it, so he's going to do it too. If he wants me to put myself out there, I'm going to put myself out there too. Or does she just think, ew, and delete it?
I think she probably laughs about it with her friends,
yeah,
which is what 20-something girls do, too, I think.
And we think of dick pics as generic in some way, like where people scrutinize the girl pictures, like girls scrutinize them, guys scrutinize them. What does she look like? How is she posing? Mm-hmm. Whereas the dick pic, it's just like, how many options you got?
Well, it's such a close-up, you know?
Yeah. Like, I guess it's sort of, you know, like there are many parts of like...
Sorry.
Just to get real, let's get into like this, these like humans are a collection of body parts question. So, I mean, obviously there are like many parts of the male body that women are attracted to, but there's only really one that is like sexualized in the way that, you know, several different parts of female bodies are. So I think, you know, a boy could send a sort of shirtless picture to a girl and it has his face in it, the face that she really likes. But it doesn't communicate sort of the same vulnerability as sending a photo of your boobs.
Right. I think it's the vulnerable. But you don't think there's anything vulnerable in sending a dick pic? I mean, there's
something
little vulnerable about that. Because guys have all sorts of hang-ups. And
yeah, I think sending a photo of you with your shirt off is just like going to the pool on a Saturday, though. So the dick has to make it in there, but then it's like, does anyone want to see it? I don't know.
No, what a strange meeting ritual. What a strange time in humanity.
Fascinating, exciting time.
I want to say one last thing about the body parts, which is that kids are pretty clever about this, and often the girls on this Instagram page would have just sent a body part. So they would just have sent their boobs, or they just sent their... It's very common to send, and kind of weird if you actually see them, to send a kind of a headless photo.
Right. And that was so interesting, too, that it was like, you know, putting together the... freckle patterns to figure out whose it was, just like, wow.
Yeah, that poor girl. It's only because she was so freckled that they figured it out. Okay, so listeners, we are going to ask you this week, go on our Facebook page and tell us, why do you sext? If you have teenagers, why you think they sext? We just would love to have a collection of the reasons so Noreen can judge you after. Just kidding. No. Just to be enlightened, so we can all be enlightened. So go on our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, all spelled out, DOUBLEX GabFest. Or if you'd rather keep it private, XXGabFest@slate.com is the email. And you can tell us in the email, don't mention my name. Okay. From sex to the kitchen. How'd you like that transition? Okay, our loyal sponsor this week, Blue Apron. Cooking and eating should be fun, but things get in the way. You're too busy. You don't actually know how to cook, so it gets stressful, and you just order out or eat cereal. So what do? You go to Blue Apron. They do all the hard stuff for you and leave you with the fun part. They come up with recipes, send you the exact ingredients you need, and give you idiot-proof instructions. For $9.99 per meal, they send the right ingredients in the right exact proportions right to your door. Meals are delicious, fresh, and not that many calories. And cooking takes about an hour, shipping is free, and they'll never send you the same meals twice. Noreen, what do they have on Blue Apron today? I'm going to make you tell us what meals they have.
These all look really good. So there's a lamb ragu with rigatoni and purple top turnips, a Parmesan-crusted chicken with kale Caesar salad and toasted hazelnuts, and a rice flake-crusted salmon with miso-smashed Japanese sweet potatoes and mustard greens.
And you should have your own cooking show.
I felt like a Brooklyn waitress, like all these like super hip dishes that I was just rattling off.
That was pretty good. So go to blueapron.com/XX, spelled out D-O-U-B-L-E-X. Two free meals if you just go to blueapron.com/XX. Okay, let's go on to our second topic, Gone Girl. Gone Girl, as Amanda Hess writes in Slate, has given us the perfect psycho bitch for our age. Amy, played in the movie by Rosamund Pike, invents a history of domestic violence, fakes a rape by a stalker ex-boyfriend, a couple of rapes actually, fakes a pregnancy and her own disappearance to pass herself off as the perfect victim, as Amanda writes, beautiful, white, pregnant, and dead. This is all true in the book, but in the movie version, it started to tip a little more hostile to women. Maybe because Ben Affleck is so good at being a lovable asshole. Maybe because in order to pull off a slick horror film, Amy is pretty critical to that. So her psychoness is really played up. And maybe it's because the movie was made by a male director and the book was written by a woman. But for whatever reason, the movie is coming off as more woman-hating than the book. So do you agree? Do you think Amy seemed less likable in the movie than she did in the book? I've thought a lot about why, but do you think she was, just to establish that?
I think there is one device that is used in the book that's really central that is not used in the movie, and that is Nick speaking to us as Nick. So in the movie, spoiler alert, I'm assuming that everyone... Should we discuss that?
Yes, let's discuss that before I start. I'm sorry, guys, but the movie's been out a little while, and we've got to spoil in order to have this conversation reasonably. So we can't be like the Culture Fest and just talk about the movie generally, because I feel like it's been out long enough. So in order to have an intelligent conversation about this, we're going to spoil. So skip to the next topic if you haven't seen the movie.
Okay, so in the movie, we meet Nick and, I think the expected viewer is supposed to think that he probably killed his wife. And we get this whole idea of like the specific type of asshole is because he's put in that position. And then in the middle of the movie, we find out that he is a victim of his psycho bitch wife who has framed him for her murder. And so every asshole thing that we have sort of learned about him, I think we then sort of see under this lens of this archetype that she has created for him or the media has created for him. Whereas in the book, we get that, but we also get his thoughts, which are often sexist. And so we can sort of experience exactly the type of sexist asshole that he is as a person, beyond this sort of made-up murderer role.
Yeah. And also the movie does that in shorthand, which is that he had an affair with his student, right? And what's weird to me is that I left the movie feeling so sympathetic to Nick, even though he had an affair with his hot college student. And I couldn't figure out why. Was that Ben Affleck? I mean, Wesley Morris in his Grantland review does a really good job of even explaining Ben Affleck's body language, like the way he walks, the way he's got a little paunch and his arms are kind of hanging, and he pulls off what I think Wesley Morris called the kind of football player past his best days look so well that you wind up sympathetic. You think, like, even if he did have an affair, like, what a psycho he's married to.
But why is it bad for women, or why is it sexist to portray one particular woman as being, like, a sociopath? Even if Nick is a little more horrible in the book itself, like, you're never really meant to think that Amy is like just a relatable every gal kind of woman. She's like absolutely nuts. And right. I mean, maybe some of what was more present in the book was like that they were like two criminally nutty people who had found each other. Like, I kept thinking the twist was going to be that they were in it together for like the life insurance money or something. And that did not turn out to be the twist. But I wanted to believe that their marriage was like two sociopaths who had found each other, which maybe says more about my optimism.
Partners in crime, yeah. As they put it in yeah. That interview. Well, Amanda, I would say you did a very good job of describing why every age has the psycho bitch it deserves and why those psycho bitches say something about the culture. culture. So, you know, we had the old psycho bitch, which was the single white female, basically, right? The bunny boiler psycho bitch. It's when we had that psycho bitches represent a cultural anxiety about a certain kind of liberated female.
Right. So in the early 90s, the late 80s, early 90s, it was this single woman who tries to ingratiate herself into the family and disrupt it. And Amy is the opposite. She, you know, represents this family that should not have been forged. And all of these tensions that are, you know, supposedly underneath this, like, perfect veneer. I don't think the movie is, like, bad for women. I really liked the movie, although movies that I tend to like seems to have no relationship to their politics.
Uh-huh. So how is she a modern woman? Just to rest there for a minute. Like, if we are going to take offense at this movie, what would it be about? She's very type A. You know, she has sort of post-its everywhere and is very ambitious for herself in a certain way. And also, this is an era in which we talk a lot about sexual assault and in which women are trying to assert themselves on that front. I'm actually going to read Wesley Morris. He was very good on this topic. He said that women today are more confrontational and less tolerant of what can seem like patriarchal or at best bureaucratic foot-dragging and opacity. They've swelled beyond campuses to include criticizing even the conduct of once untouchable professional athletes. And then along comes a major work of Hollywood fiction based on a huge bestseller written by a woman about a woman whose greatest power is to cry wolf. So it seems like a way of digging at this particular form of independence. Like, we are gonna, you know, we are gonna accuse even football players of assault. And so then there's a movie in which you've got a woman who's like faking not one, not two, but three cases of domestic assault. And actually, the movie the scene which reminded me most of this quote was the scene with her, not the stalker boyfriend, but where Nick is in the cafe confronting the old boyfriend who she had accused of rape several years earlier. And the guy was like pathetic and his life had been ruined and he was on a sex registry for the rest of his life. And you could see he was a broken man because of her, which is, I think, now like every man's worst nightmare of the modern woman. The modern college girl is going to do that to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's manipulative to the nth degree, right? Which you see in all of these interactions with men. She knows exactly what they want. And that's something that Gillian Flynn explored in a passage in the book that's become very famous about the cool girl,
yeah.
Which I'll read part of it because it's just great. So the passage goes, "Men always say that is the defining compliment, don't they? She's a cool girl. Being the cool girl means I am a hot, brilliant, funny woman who adores football, poker, dirty jokes, and burping, who plays video games, drinks cheap beer, loves threesomes and anal sex, and jams hot dogs and hamburgers into her mouth like she's hosting the biggest culinary gangbang while somehow maintaining a size 2, because cool girls are above all hot. Hot and understanding. Cool girls never get angry. They smile in a chagrined, loving manner and let their men do whatever they want. Go ahead, shit on me. I don't mind. I'm the cool girl." And so what Amy is doing is pretending to be the cool girl. And Gillian Flynn is saying you can never truly be a cool girl. It's only like a means to an end. And that end is like controlling your man or something.
Right. I mean, I think part of the problem with the movie is that we all already read the book. And so in the book, we are actually emotionally invested in Amy's version of events. We don't yet know that she's the psycho. I mean, I read the book a long time ago before I knew Amy was the psycho. And so I'm kind of pulled along on Amy's story before I know that it's false. And so a lot of what she says gets lodged within me, like this cool girl speech. And I think, yeah, sister, like, that's right. And then I find out she's a psycho, but that stuff is still in me. Whereas the movie doesn't really have that opportunity because I kind of already know that her diary is fake and everything she's saying is fake and she's a psycho. So Amy never really even has an opportunity to kind of win me over in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I sort of liked, and I, again, it's difficult for me to really understand how well this was portrayed in the movie. Maybe it was portrayed well, was that as manipulative as she is and as sort of indicative of this, you know, created fear over women crying wolf that Amy is representing, she ends up walking herself into a situation with, like, basically an abusive boyfriend, mm-hmm. this guy who locks her in a house and tells her what to do and sort of keeps her as his pet. So it almost seems like all of these things that she has created are sort of retroactively justified, or that perhaps her history with this guy may have sort of, like, been in a way, like, actually criminal or abusive. And that I think, makes it more interesting. But also at the end, you know, she, again, walks herself into this situation where she's having a baby with her husband, which she did not want to do. And so nobody really gets what they want at the end. But I did think it was an odd moment in the movie where Ben Affleck's lawyer, played by Tyler Perry, who I thought was wonderful, says, wow, you guys are like the most fucked up people I've ever seen. I guess you deserve each other. And I totally got that in the book. I didn't necessarily get that in the movie.
No, you didn't have a sense.
He seemed like a doofus.
Yeah, you didn't have the sense that Nick was... What was fucked up about Nick? He's like a hapless Missouri guy. And I think the crime against her was the crime of making her invisible, which is a universal marital crime. Like, I am invisible to you, you are invisible to me, is something that happens in a marriage that's a little different than sort of psycho or sexist or what the cool girl is describing. You do not get the sense that Nick in the movie is the kind of guy who, you know, wants her to eat hot. He's just like a Missouri guy, you know?
You also don't get the sense that she ever did that,
right.
Which is a little right. weird. I thought her performance was great, but I did not see her chugging beers or, like, inhaling hot dogs.
Right.
I have a question about psycho bitches generally. Are they always blonde? Because you wrote about, you know, the bunny boiler was blonde. She's blonde. I think there's this, like, type A teetering on the edge of something woman who's always portrayed as blonde in these movies.
Yeah, that's something that Susan Faludi talks about in her book Backlash when she talks about Fatal Attraction, that there is always this setup between the light woman and the dark woman, and the light woman is the girl next door looking brunette girl, and the dark woman is, ironically or not, she's blonde.
Mm-hmm. Bottle blonde, but still
yeah.
blonde.
Do we want to talk about any of David Fincher's other films at all? I did think it was interesting that he directed the American Girl with Dragon Tattoo movie, which presents its own, like, hyper-feminist version of the psycho bitch, where the heroine is actually institutionalized because people write her off as insane. She is actually raped. And she goes on this sort of, like, almost masculine revenge fantasy where she tortures her rapist. She ends up, you know, saving Daniel Craig, who is in this. He becomes the sort of sexualized bait for her to save from a murderer. And so, and I really liked that movie, although there were some, like, there were ways that it was told in, I think, a really masculine sense. But I don't think that David Fincher is just sort of, like, a clueless bro when it comes to putting women on screen.
That they are opposites. They really are opposites, these two female characters. And maybe that's your hint that if he bleaches your hair, you're going to be the bad psycho bitch. And if he makes your hair brown, you're going to be like the bad, like capital B bad psycho bitch, you know, because she was not blonde. Okay, let's move on to the male feminist.
Speaking of David Fincher,
is he a male feminist or is he not a male feminist? In a New York Magazine story, Kat Stoffel writes that she has a number of friends who do right by women in so many ways, but that they would never call themselves male feminists, and she can't say she blames them. For one thing, she writes, there's something suspicious about anyone eager to identify with the oppressed, especially in an age when the sensitive guy thing gets you a lot of points. For another, the professional male feminists out there, Pasadena City College professor Hugo Schweitzer, Charles Clymer, who runs the Equality for Women Facebook page, had turned out to be seriously problematic suspect characters. In Schweitzer's case, she writes, student-stooping, suicidal, homicidal alcoholic who couldn't handle his haters, especially when they were women of color. So, the male feminist, where do you feel like the culture is turning on the male feminist? There was a time when the male feminist was welcomed, and now the male feminist is an object of great suspicion?
No, I think the male feminist is having a little bit of a moment, thanks to Aziz Ansari, who went on one of the late shows, I forget which one, and had a whole riff about how he'd become a, you know, his girlfriend had taught him that he was a feminist and that feminism just meant believing that men and women have equal rights, something to that effect. And he was celebrated. You know, everyone was like, this is the greatest thing ever. Aziz Ansari, he's like a great ally. And then other people were like, well, actually, feminism is a lot more complicated than that. And that is like feminism 101 and get on our level. You need to like understand who bell hooks it. I mean, people just went off.
I actually just read a long dissertation by a sociologist who's based in North Carolina. Her name is Chris McComber, and she interviewed a bunch of male activists and female activists who are working against, like, gendered violence. So people working in rape crisis centers or in anti-domestic violence centers. And she has found that that exact dynamic that Noreen is describing has, like, gone back for decades and decades. So there are some women who say, yes, the most important thing we need is for men to come into this space and to talk to other men about why it's not good to treat women poorly. And then there are other feminists who were really annoyed by the pedestal that these men were put on, because they were saying, you know, this basic thing this guy said in a meeting is something that, as one of the women put it, the exact same thing that Ida B. Wells was saying, like, back in the 1800s. So why are we giving him a medal for that? So I think this is a really longstanding tension that is now, as feminism, or, like, the conversation about feminism, identification with feminism, is really spreading beyond these, like, really obvious centers of feminist action to celebrities and to journalists. In a way, we're just recreating these old dynamics.
Although this is what I think is new about this moment, I hope I can articulate this. I found it interesting to dig into the Equality for Women Facebook page, that Charles Clymer thing where everyone said he was an asshole and there was a girl who worked for him who basically was like, you are not recognizing enough your own white male privilege. And he just lost it after a while. He just completely, completely lost it in a letter that was like, please accept my invitation of Hyde and go fuck yourself. You know, I mean, he really wrote. But the point in his letter where, and once he went overboard, he was never forgiven. He writes, here's a good question. What the fuck have you done for women's rights lately other than troll the page I created? So there's a way in which, like, aligning yourself as having the right status has become really important. Calling yourself exactly the right thing. You know, just having the image of your page look exactly right. And I often wonder, you know, so is that become a substitute for actual work on issues? Is just sort of putting yourself in the right space become the thing that we do these days, basically because we don't want to talk about the actual real problem, which is class inequality in America today, because that's, like, too hard and difficult. So we of the privileged writing class, kind of this is where we posture and defend ourselves as opposed to, like, doing the actual work. So I weirdly found myself not thinking, like, you go, Charles, but thinking a little bit like, maybe he has a point. Like, why does he have to say every time, Charles, me of white privilege, you know, blah, 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 when he's actually, like, doing something?
And social media should make that more obvious, right? It's like, you know, I always sort of find it really funny when people on social media do this sort of as a identification, like, as a father, you know, as a white male privilege. It's like, we know, basically. Like, we know.
Right.
So it is this weird performativity. Speaking as someone who does not do any, like, real work in feminism, I am also sympathetic to this idea that because I'm a woman, like, I am just allowed to sort of write about things in a way that men are not. And I thought it was really interesting, the thing that Kat wrote in that story, which was, you know, people, there's always this suspicion of people who want to identify with the oppressed. But it strikes me that, like, that is what female feminists are supposed to do. Ideally, like, we are not arguing for rights that will largely benefit ourselves. Like, most of us are, like, doing pretty well. And so that seems to be a kind of good thing, is to be able to look beyond yourself, and something that we all have to do within the feminist movement.
I think it depends on how central the person makes it to sort of their persona. Like, there is something a little strange about someone who is a straight white male who the first thing he advertises about himself is that he's a feminist. Like, the very first thing.
Like a professional male feminist.
Yeah, like a professional. That turns me off.
Right.
And, you know, so on a, if it's the first thing a guy says to you, oh, I'm a feminist, like, it's a co-option that I can't explain why it rubs me the wrong way. Like, if a guy says I'm not a feminist, well, that is terrible. You know, there's some way, and I don't envy men for having to walk this line, but there's some way that you can sort of just, like, be one without necessarily needing to be patted on the back for it. I think that's part of what Kat is reacting to and what I certainly react to is the like, give me a gold star. I believe in your rights. You know, there's something a little like gross about that.
This is actually something so that the sociologist Chris McComber wrote about, too, where she would ask women sort of like, what is a good male ally? And a lot of them would say they would use the sort of definition of pornography. It's like, well, I don't know exactly what the definition of a good ally is, but I know it when I see it. But more likely, and I think something that happens on social media a lot, is like, I know when you are doing something that is not good. Mm-hmm. Like, I can recognize that instantly. And I definitely have that experience constantly. What I sometimes wonder when I sort of see men sort of dipping their toes into like feminist comments on Twitter and stuff, and some of them really rub me the wrong way and others don't, I often wonder, is it like, do I just not like this person? As a person, do I not like their sense of humor?
Is there a correct way for a man to dip into a feminist debate as opposed to just be a good dude who's supportive of you and doesn't say anything really obnoxious?
I think it depends on the debate. There's a different way for every debate. Like, a lot of the issues that we talk about as feminist issues, like, you know, childcare and things like that aren't actually feminist issues. I mean, they are, but they're like
sort family issues.
Family issues, right? And so I don't feel uncomfortable. But like when a guy is talking about the objectification of women, it's a little more problematic in some ways, you know? Like I think people have a tendency to protest too much in an instance like that.
So Hugo Schweitzer, who got in trouble for many, many things, among them his Jezebel columns, I sort of felt like he should have packaged himself as a sex writer. Like he never should have. He knew a lot about that. He actually had interesting things to say. And if he had said, oh, I'm a sex writer for Jezebel, as opposed to I am a professional male feminist, then people would have accepted it and fought over his posts that were about what men want from sex. He was kind of mansplaining, when a man does this thing to you that you perceive as humiliating, it's not actually humiliating. It's the man asking for affirmation. And it was just, you know, okay, well, if he was a sex writer, we could just say, well, no, and debate about it. But instead,
right. And I think one of the points that Kat was making was like, you just go to Esquire. That's where you belong. There are many places for you to do that. But I also think that social media can sometimes offer a really elegant solution to all of this stuff, where if you are a man who is interested in contributing to any of these debates, like the great thing about Twitter is that there is no point that you want to make that like somebody hasn't made that you can just retweet.
Right. That's a good.
So maybe you should just do
that. That's our advice to all the male feminists out there. Retweet. When in doubt, retweet. I love that. Okay, we're going to move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I have two things to recommend. One is a video from the New York Times of second graders who go to Daniel, the very fancy restaurant in Manhattan. And it's the most adorable thing I've ever seen. There are these Brooklyn second graders who like have a certain knowledge of food, it appears, but they are just confounded by these very, very fancy dishes. And they, you know, they like the steak and they like the sweet thing at the end. It's very funny. You should look it up. We'll put a link in the page. The other thing I want to endorse is a feud between Gwyneth Paltrow and Martha Stewart, which I am obsessed with. I'm a little bit obsessed with both of those women. Definitely team Martha. So Gwyneth Paltrow has been, you know, trying to brand herself as a lifestyle guru. And
what did she say to Obama?
Oh, my God.
It was crazy.
You're so handsome. I can't speak.
Oh,
she
God.
Hosted a she hosted a fundraiser for him and just like hit on him, which was embarrassing. But she has.
And she put up her. I don't have a ring anymore.
Did she
no,
do
she
that?
Didn't. I'm
oh,
just saying.
It would be amazing.
This is Hannah's fan fiction, her Gwyneth Paltrow fan fiction.
My Gwyneth fan fiction, yeah.
So, you know, Gwyneth is kind of trying to become Martha. And Martha said, well, she should go back to acting. Like, if she were confident in her acting, she wouldn't need to try to be me. And then Gwyneth stole, like, the former head of Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia or whatever. And Gwyneth was like, I'm just happy she feels competitive with me. And now, the best moment in this feud yet is the newest issue of Martha Stewart Living magazine features a spread on pies that's titled Conscious Coupling. I should have pulled up the text, but it's something like, you know, every table has a married couple you just envy for how like perfect they are together. And it's like this riff on marriage that then you see it's like actually about pie and how the pumpkin is perfect for the whipped cream. But it's a huge dig at Gwyneth Paltrow, who, you know, famously consciously uncoupled from her husband. And I just like the premeditation, involved in that and the way she tied it to pies. Mm-hmm. It was just perfect. I mean, like, what's Gwyneth going
to
do?
Oh, my God. We so should have talked about that. Not that we would have anything to discuss or, like, weighty matters to surface, just to, like, give you the mic on that and let you talk as much as you want. I am going to endorse the movie reviews of Wesley Morris on Grantland. I read his Gone Girl review, and I just could not stop reading his reviews. I just think he is so smart and is able to take any movie or even cultural artifact and just explode it into every important issue of the day. He really is just unbelievably great. So you should, any movie that comes out, you should read what Wesley Morris has to say about it. I'm not sure it will help you decide whether or not to see the movie, but it will make the movie seem 1,000 times more interesting than it possibly really is. Amanda.
So I'm going to endorse the work of Anita Sarkeesian, who is this, if you've never seen any of her work and have only read her stories about her, she has been getting horrific death threats, bomb threats, rape threats from men in the gaming community who are upset by sort of feminist arguments that she makes about video games. So I would suggest that everyone go and watch her YouTube series, Tropes Versus Women, and just, like, experience how totally wonderful and lovely and rational they are and how they do not deserve this insane reaction from all of these oppressed video gamer dudes. So go to YouTube and watch Tropes Versus Women.
Excellent recommendation. Now, which are you going to do first, that or the Gwyneth Paltrow Martha Stewart? Well, thank you all. If you want more information about the show, go on our show page, slate.com/XX. Once again, go to our Facebook page and tell us if you sexed, why you sexed, and what you would tell your teens who sexed. That's facebook.com/XXGabFest, spelled out D-O-U-B-L-E-X, GabFest. Our email is XXGabFest@slate.com if you'd rather do it privately. We'd like to thank Anne Hepperman for recording and producing this podcast. We'd like to thank Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. For Noreen and Amanda, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Martha Stewart, Martha Stewart, spackle, pain, restore, horsehair plaster. Martha Stewart, Martha Stewart, salvage old houses from disaster. Plow the fields, plant vintage wheat, then design designer sheets. Oh, Martha Stewart, Martha Stewart, I sure wish I could be like you.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.